So, Game 7 could have gone better for the Leafs and Caps, huh?
You think? It was, could there be two teams that complete loggerheads for outcome? You know, not of actually the, you know, the outcome of the game, but how they arrived there. They both arrived at the same, you know, at the same part of the mountain they were heading to, but they just took up to totally different paths. I can't imagine two more polar opposites of teams in Game 7 than the Maple Leafs and the Washington Capitals yesterday, Wish.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty stunning. It was an interesting juxtaposition between the two, I'd have to say.
And here's the question. There's an old saying that goes like this. If you're going to miss heaven, don't miss it by 2 inches. And that really speaks more to the Washington Capitals last night than the Toronto Maple Leafs. The idea that if you're going to miss, really miss. I mean, really miss at this sucker. But then there's another school of thought that says, you know what? I mean, it's better to have, you know, to, you know, the old loved and lost and never loved at all. It's better to go up, you know, show up and give a shit than not at all. It's better to, you know, show up for 2 periods and a half than show up for no periods and no half at all. And that sort of, you know, leads right into the QOD today, which is, what's the worst way to lose? The way the Maple Leafs did last night or the way the Washington Capitals did? And it's interesting. The response comes back, Wish, totally down the middle. Down the middle.
At Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on Twitter, hashtag at NBSW, PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com on ye old email. As my friend Matt Shepard puts it, either way is tough. Do you want to not show up or choke? That's like choosing how to die.
It's like, would you rather your team played 2.5 periods or no periods? That's what it comes down to. Because there is, you know, have you found that there's this like prevailing sentiment and feeling in sports right now that it's all or nothing? That you have to either completely go for it and win everything or completely bottom out and completely rebuild from the bottom. Scorched earth policy. There can be no, that's one thing that I really don't like about sports right now is there's no room for the in between. There's no room for the middle class in sports. You have to either be a total champion or a total loser selling hope. You're either selling completely selling wins or completely selling hope. Well, I don't like it.
It's the world is separated into teams that are looking forward to the draft lottery and teams are looking forward to winning a championship. That's pretty much how it is. Right? So, you know, here's the interesting thing about the Leafs last night that I was just talking to somebody in Buffalo about this. Did that series go from being a positive learning experience to yet another dagger in the back of that franchise?
I think it still comes back to a learning experience.
I don't think it does. I'll tell you why.
How so?
Why? Okay, for two reasons. We could all kind of just do the good puppy thing like we did with the Islanders. Oh, look, he didn't mess the house. What a cute little puppy. Oh, he's going to grow up to be a big, strong dog who challenges for the Stanley Cup. Or we could look at this thing and say the Toronto Maple Leafs, incidentally, a what seed, Merrick, were they in this series?
Maple Leafs would have been a five seed.
So not an 8 seed, although they were treated as such, a 5 seed. The Toronto Maple Leafs allowed something to happen that had never happened before in the history of the National Hockey League. They allowed a team to come back in a Game 7 down 3 goals in the third period. That is pathetic. And the other thing that's pathetic is that you had a chance to close out this team at a Game 7 in advance. You come home to the Toronto Sun, not calling you sweet little puppies that learn how to not mess the house, not calling you students that will one day become the teachers, calling you chokers. Mm-hmm. You have gone from being a student in class learning how to win in the playoffs to being another sad chapter in the history of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and that's how it went down.
No, I don't think so. See, I looked at it this way. This was a Maple Leafs team that in those last couple of games were punching above their weight class. And it really was a series. The Maple Leafs really had no business being in. Well, when you consider how the Boston Bruins...
Hold on a second. Because they're a number 5 seed. Like, I know the Eastern Conference sucks on toast, but this is a 5 seed. When did we start getting into this thing where franchises like the Toronto Maple Leafs, with star players and great goaltenders and coaches that won Stanley Cups, are all of a sudden these terrible little teams that aren't expected to win? When did we get to a point in the playoffs where 5 seeds aren't expected to win? How is that possible?
Well, I'll tell you how it's possible. What I want you to do, and I'll let you take your time with this,
please.
Go back and look at the history of the last 3 years of the games between the Boston Bruins and the Toronto Maple Leafs. So you can look at the five seeds and while you're a five seed, you should be able to stand up on your own 2 feet. You'll defend yourself like a man. Put your hands up. But then you look at who they're playing. This is a team that has owned them for years. Okay? Go back and look at the history of this. I mean, if it were the Maple Leafs facing off against the Ottawa Senators, or the Maple Leafs facing off against the Montreal Canadiens, or whomever, anyone other than, like, what did we say about this series going in? The Leafs are marching into slaughter. This team trounces the Toronto Maple Leafs. And they should have trounced the Maple Leafs, but you know what? Boston got sleepy. Everyone focuses on how much the Maple Leafs, you know, stunk it up for 10 minutes last night, choosing rather not to focus on the fact that it took, you know, however many periods for Horton and Lucic and Zdeno Chara and Patrice Bergeron to finally wake up. And all of a sudden, that was the Boston Bruins team we thought was going to be there all series long. They caught a sleepy Bruins team, is what they caught. That's how I looked at it.
Were they sleepy in Game 5?
You know what I'm
talking
about.
Were they sleepy in Game 6? Were they? Okay, so in other words, the Boston Bruins were the ones that were going to determine who wins or loses the series. The Toronto Maple Leafs are at the whim of their opponent. There was five points that separated these two teams in the standings.
Wish, look, give your head a shake? Look at the history of these two teams. Look what happens when the Boston Bruins and the Maple Leafs get together. It doesn't end well for the Toronto Maple Leafs, I assure you, Greg Wyshynski.
I want to know when we actually place expectations on these playoff teams, on teams that make the fucking playoffs. Like, when do we actually put expectations on playoff teams and not treat them like, oh, how cute the Leafs made it. Look, everyone can have a party in the square. Give me a break. They had a three-goal lead in Game 7. And the third
and a young team.
Here's your gold star.
No one's saying give him a frickin' gold star, you chimp. No one's saying that. All I'm saying is they lost to a better team. They lost to a much better team. A team that should have had their way with the Toronto Maple Leafs over the entire series. A miracle for the Maple Leafs that it got that far. What was your expectation of this going in?
My expectation was that they were going to lose, but lose in six. And others had them losing in seven.
And instead they lose in seven, and that becomes an embarrassment.
But the point is that I wasn't picking the Boston in four. It was obviously going to be a hard fought series. I'm sorry. Again, you know where I come from on this. I come from a guy who has to root for a team that, God forbid, has expectations on it. And I'm sick and tired of teams that make the playoffs and have this patented bulletproof excuse of, well, it's not their time to win yet. Well, when is it your time to win when you're a five seed? Maybe when you're a five seed, it's time to win, no?
Oh, I don't know. First time in the playoffs for 9 years? And you're going to say this team had expectations? Come on, bud.
Listen, I'm saying...
I was born at night, but I wasn't born last night.
Right? This is wonderful Teflon excuse for teams. And I'm sorry, yeah, you might be able to have that if they go into Game 7 and they lose a hard-fought Game 2-1. Oh, man. You really gave it your all, Toronto. Good on you. They had a 3-goal lead in the third period. They were going to win
the
game.
Yeah,
and they blew it.
And you know,
it means that you're a choking team. It doesn't mean that you should get a pat in the head and you'll learn from your mistakes and you'll come back next year and try even harder. No, it means that you choked. It means you had a game that you won and a series that you won and you blew it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're a tough guy, I guess. That's it.
I'm not a tough guy. I'm simply saying that
everything is black and white in the Wyshynski world. There's no shades of gray at all.
Oh, look, they're raising their sticks at center ice. We should all applaud them because they tried so hard. They had the game won, and they pissed it away. And this will be yet another pissed away moment in the annals of Leafs history.
What is worse then, if you want to talk about the annals of history, what is worse then, that or a Washington Capitals team that decided not even to put on their skates to come out and play last night?
Well, that's the punchline of this whole thing. Is like, as bad as the Leafs look in this situation, the Caps look even worse. And what the difference is this is the first cut of the knife in the Leafs psyche, in this group's psyche. But this Capitals team, the knife is plunged deep into their cerebral cortex. This is now a legacy of Game 7 losses on home ice for an Alex Ovechkin Capitals team. And the idea that they get played out of the building offensively by the New York Rangers in a Game 7? Now, granted, the Rangers did a really cool thing, which is that they decided to let loose the hounds a little bit in Game 7 and play a little bit more of an offensive style than they had in previous games, which is pretty ballsy when you consider how closely these games have been played, mainly because of the Rangers' defensive style. but to not even show up, Merrick. To give up, to get all slouchy-shouldered after the Aaron Asham goal, then to see the whole thing go to hell in the second period, is even more embarrassing than the Leafs' loss.
The thing about the Washington Capitals loss, too, is you don't just look at it as the final loss. I think you have to look at game 6 and 7 as a combination of... I look at 6 and 7 as one collective game, where the Washington Capitals, where, you know, the offensive juggernaut, here come the high-flying Capitals, who are going to fill the nets, didn't get a single goal. Couldn't score a single goal in those last two games. Not a single goal.
Now,
and I fully expected today to hear about how horribly Alexander Ovechkin was injured. I thought it was going to be one of these like Bobby Bonds stories of how he had to keep his foot in the boot for 3 days because if he took the boot off, his foot would swell and never be able to get his skate off again. And we heard that he was banged up. And then I find out today he's going to play for Russia in the Worlds. Sorry. I'm not buying that he's injured if he's going to play for Russia in the Worlds. So
here's the thing about this series, though, and let me see if you agree on this one. Lundqvist, I thought, played better in this series than he had played against the Capitals in any other series. And there's
Correct.
No question that the Rangers do have two guys, in Girardi and McDonough, they can deploy to take care of anybody's top line. Those two things combined, I think, made it very difficult for the Ovechkin line to play well. Ovechkin himself, I thought, didn't play poorly, but now we're back at the beginning of the season. Now we're back to a situation where he's not putting goals on the board, but he's doing all of the things that you can ask for him, but his job primarily is to put goals on the board. So do you feel all right about that or not if you're a Caps fan and Alex Ovechkin has one goal in the series? I'm going to guess not, but I'm also going to say that Lundqvist in this series, to me, was more of a difference maker than he was in any other series they played against the Capitals.
I buy that. And further to Alexander Ovechkin point, I'm not sure where you're at on this, but I've had it with hearing the offensive output really isn't there, but the things he's doing away from the puck that are really helping his game. He's doing other little things in the game that are really helping, you know, that are complementing what the coach is trying to do here. Fiddlers fiddle and dancers dance. If you're Alexander Ovechkin, if you're Evgeny Malkin, if you're Sidney Crosby, your job is to score. That is job number one.
And I also think with Ovechkin, though, like you could maybe play that song in Game 6 when he had several good chances against Lundqvist and was shut down by a goalie that's playing out of his mind right now. But here's the thing. If you take the average shot attempts for Ovechkin from Games 1 through 6, it's about 10 or 11, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Game 7, it was 5. He had 5 shot attempts in Game 7. He didn't show up for Game 7. Now, granted, Game 7 was pretty much done as soon as they got up 3-0, but he didn't show up. And you know, it must slaughter Capitals fans to see the same story play out no matter who the coach is, no matter who the goalie is. We'll get to the goalie thing in a second. No matter what system they play, whatever the case, it's the same story every single time this happens, which is that the star players don't perform in the spotlight. And then there's no secondary scoring behind them to pick up the slack. Ovechkin, one goal. Ribeiro, one goal. Green, 4 points in 4 games, then nothing in 3 games. Backstrom disappeared. Johansson disappeared. Brower disappeared. Nothing from these guys.
Brower got one last night off the stick of Michael Delzato.
You're right. And Green got one. Exactly. So the point is, it's the same story for these guys every single time. And what's the solution going to be? I mean, what is the solution? There's only two solutions in my mind for this, Merrick. The first is that you break up the team, which is what they were going to do at the trade deadline before the team caught fire. Or you take one last desperate attempt at trying to make this team into a champion rather than an unconfident bunch of jellyfish in the playoffs when adversity hits, and try to inject as many Stanley Cup rings into that locker room as you possibly can, as quickly as we possibly can.
You know what's interesting? I'll tell you what's interesting here. When you look at the Washington Capitals, do you not say to yourself, well, the one of two things they need here is either more change, or do you say to yourself, what this team needs is more consistency? Like, when you look at the number of coaches Alexander Ovechkin has had, not unlike the number of coaches that Steven Stamkos has had, not even unlike when you go down the litany from, I guess it was sort of like Nick Polano to Harry Neal to Brad Park and Jacques Demers and Brian Murray.
Oh,
Not unlike, Jacques Demers, the senator now from Ottawa. Not unlike the amount of coaches that Steve Yzerman had early in his career. Like, I've always, I always wonder what it does to a player to have that much coaching, a young, like, superstar player, to have that much coaching change in your career early. Happened to Eisman, he came out of it okay. Stamkos seems to be doing just fine, thank you very much. But I just wonder Glenn Hanlon, Bruce Boudreau, Dale Hunter, Adam Oates. It's four coaches there Ovechkin's already had.
Yeah.
Like, I just wonder if there doesn't need to be more of a consistency specifically behind the bench in Washington. Like, love him or not.
No.
Does not further cement the fact that Adam Oates has to stay? Like, they just can't keep doing this.
He'll definitely stay.
But no, stay like a long time.
He's probably the last coach McPhee's hired. But
I believe that.
The coaching thing's interesting for the Caps because of the coaches that Ovechkin has had, which one has a Stanley Cup ring? I'll wait.
What's that?
And that's the point, is that none of these guys have actually won anything tangibly in the National Hockey League as coaches, and there's always been this lingering thought in D.C. that George McPhee doesn't want to hire a guy that could usurp George McPhee, or that is going to shine up brighter than George McPhee, or is going to he'll have to share the power with. You know, that's why, if you bring Ken Hitchcock to Washington, you're bringing a guy in that's going to want to elbow in on McPhee and start making personnel decisions, yeah? But everybody else I think, is more controllable, no?
Oh, God, yeah. Totally.
Right.
But and that goes back, we've talked about this on the podcast a lot, that goes back to the dynamic between the general manager and the coach, and you never want to bring in someone who's going to end up punting you. And this is a lot of what happened to Ted Nolan in Buffalo, folks. All right. This is what happened to Ted Nolan in Buffalo. Exactly what Greg is talking about. Just put it all to rest. Conspiracy theories. That's what happened in Buffalo with Ted Nolan. And that's what every general manager around the NHL said.
I don't know.
That ain't going to happen to me.
Sex and racism sex and all sorts of things.
No. Racist sex. No, that's what happened. Nudging in on the GM. It doesn't go as well.
Oh, is that what they're calling it these days? Oh.
Here's
the thing on the Caps. I'm kind of capsed out. I did 2 hours on the Caps this morning on the local ESPN affiliate. But
what's the vibe, by the way?
What are?
Because Maple Leafs fans are still over the mic. Last night it was right away. It was horror. It was collapse. It was disaster. Most Leafs fans that I listened to on talk radio in Toronto today are sort of at least they got in. It's a building block. Now, mind you, as has been raised before, you have to be wary of, the team that just sneaks into the playoffs and you think, okay, that's a building block for the future because how did that work out for Colorado in 2010?
Yeah.
So this isn't a slam dunk for your Leafs fans listening right now. Just because you got in, you're going to make it in next year and subsequent years because personally, I don't believe that they're going to make it in next year. I still think this team has a lot of growing to do. And the one thing the playoffs do, and we saw with Toronto wide open, this is the one great thing about, I love this about the playoffs. We see with every single team, it reveals what you have. Playoffs really show you what you do have and you don't have. Cause you can hide a lot of mistakes in 82 games. You can hide a lot of mistakes in regular season. In the playoffs, there ain't nowhere to hide. Specifically in a 7-game series against a team that gives you nothing but fits. And that's what I love about it. And you saw the gaping holes in the Maple Leafs over these 7 games.
Despite the fact
that it went 7.
But I'll tell you what you found though. You found you have a goalie. That's for sure.
Yeah, although he looked rattled.
He looked rattled last night
in that 10 minutes. You can talk about the defensive collapse. You can talk about Cody Franson bad plays. You can talk about a lot of things last night. But he looked rattled. And here's what I can't understand.
Yeah.
When all of this was happening in the third period yesterday, I mean, it's all happening quick. It's under 10 minutes, bro. Under 10 minutes, all this is happening to the Maple Leafs. Why didn't Randy Carlyle call timeout?
That's a good question. That's a great question.
The whole time I'm thinking like, okay, Carlyle's calling timeout now. Okay, there's no time. Why are you not calling a timeout? This is a young team. Why do you not try to settle them down?
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out why he didn't use a timeout. I went back and looked. I'm like, did Carlyle already use a timeout here? Why is he not calling a timeout? Sell your guys down. In the words of Bob Cole, everything is happening. Settle them down. Timeout.
We have Drew Amanda coming up on the show, so I know that we need to get to the opening. But three things real quick about the Capitals. Okay.
All right.
You asked about the vibe here. I think the vibe is stunned disbelief. It's now scratching and clawing and trying to find out what is the new different thing that we're going to do this time to try to figure out how to win in the playoffs. And here's the thing. What are the three things the Capitals never had in the Ovechkin era? They've never had a coach with a Stanley Cup ring and a pedigree to match, a Quenneville, a Randy Carlyle even. They've not had that. Are they going to have one now? No. Oates is coming back, so let's scratch that off the list. They've not had a shutdown, stud, 25-minute-a-night defensive defenseman. Can you find one? Is there a Pronger out there for him? I don't know.
There's a Weber out there. I think there's a Weber out there.
There's a Weber out there. There is. It would cost you. It'd cost you to get him, but that's the kind of thing they've not had. Okay, they've also not had, and correct me if I'm wrong, a goaltender that you go into the series expecting is going to win multiple games on his own. Due respect to Braden Holtby.
They've only had one of those in their history, and his name is Olaf Kolzig.
Yep, you're right. You're right. And the question is, do you need that? I floated the Ryan Miller idea on the show this morning, and I got killed for it. Murdered for it. Like I was talking about them mortgaging the team. You get him for 1 year. See if that works. That's all I'm saying. Just see if it works. Bring him in, see if it works. Because honestly, as much as I love Braden Holtby, I think he's a great kid, and I think that's why he gets a pass for this series and a pass for not playing all that great during the regular season. Gave up 13 goals in three of the losses.
But I mean, when it came down to it, wasn't the issue they couldn't score goals?
No, that's the issue. I agree, but I think you put it all in one big pot. But you know what you also need sometimes is you need a save. I'm not saying. I'm not saying the series is on Holtby. It's not. But I'm just saying that if you want to look at every facet of the team, I don't agree with the idea that you walk away from the series saying, "Well, goaltending is not an issue." 13 goals in three losses.
It is an issue.
The Rangers.
I don't think it's the big. I don't think it's. I know. That's and not even Rick Nash. Right. Like Rick Nash still hasn't found the Matt Zuccarello scored last night. Aaron Asham kicked the party off last night.
Right.
You see that was man, I love Aaron Asham too, but dude, that's a bad shot. There's no way
bad
that goal should
up,
go in.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Like a bad that goal that should not go in
between
on
the legs. There's a little bit of a screen. Eesh. It's still Aaron Asham, right? Shoot the puck.
Oh,
I mean, I often have a theory when I see goals like that where I imagine for a moment Braden Holtby sees who it is shooting and says, oh, come on.
Yeah, whatever.
Exactly.
I'm going to wave at the parade. Oh, look, there's Santa. Okay, it's
right.
Fine. No
like problem. Whenever this Cam Jansen scores a goal, I'm just like, okay, that guy didn't think he was going to shoot the puck anywhere near than that. All right. So the question today, we're getting a ton of results. We'll definitely get back to this subject because you guys have been amazing with this question so far. Better to lose like the Leafs or better to lose like the Capitals? PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com, at Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on Twitter, hashtag at MVSW. And with that, let's start the show proper, shall we? There we go.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
We're going to get corner offices out of this one for sure, Greg. Right away, your BS detector should go off. Why do I know this crap? Are you insane?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
You and I are not quite that dissimilar.
La 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 la, hockey, hockey, hockey.
Seattle is playing excellent defense these days.
What does that even mean?
Debate hockey.
So much junior hockey knowledge in that big juicy brain.
Oh, yeah.
Pop culture.
See, I kind of look at our podcast here like Jazz Odyssey.
There's some bloggers that are great, that are entertaining, that are factual. It's fabulous.
Damn right, JD.
And more hockey.
Just what we need to shoot off the side of the barn. That's how I developed my wrist shot, shooting frozen cow patties in Lloydminster.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Merrick versus Wyshynski, huh? Andrew Leach writes
Amazing
in with regard to the Caps fan vibe after Game 7 last night. The vibe from one Caps fan, not this shit again, it's incredibly frustrating. The fact that my team manages to blow it every single spring has built to the point where it's legitimately reducing my enjoyment of the playoff tournament, which is a goddamn shame. I almost wish they could not make it for a couple of years so I could enjoy watching. Yeah, so that's the vibe for some Caps fans here.
Wow. I wish
they hope that they miss the playoffs so they can get back to enjoying. Good God.
I got that. Someone sent me I can't remember who it was. I apologize that they don't have it in front of me. Sent me a tweet saying, well, my Maple Leafs are gone. Now I can finally enjoy the playoffs without having to have a rooting interest. Welcome to where I live. Honestly, yeah. It is a lot of fun to watch hockey this way, to not have
it. Well, you know, it's fun.
And I get it. Because I just don't have that rooting interest in the team.
It's funny. I've as a Devils fan, I didn't get to experience that, but once in about a 20-year span. But now I've experienced it through the last 3 years, with a nice run to the finals mixed in. I don't know. It's a tough. As a fan, I want my team in every postseason and will live with the anguish of seeing them eliminated. As a journalist, yeah, it is kind of easier to do this job when the Devils aren't in the playoffs, to be quite honest.
As William Faulkner called it in Sound and the Fury, which you talked about last week, is hypothetical held symmetry above the flesh. That's what you're talking about. And with that, we go from William Faulkner to our man, the man of teal, as we call him, color analyst for the San Jose Sharks, Drew Remenda. How are you today, Drew?
I'm good, gents. Hey, may I ask you guys a question first?
Please. Yeah.
Okay, as you know, in the first round where the Sharks played Vancouver, I made a comment about two certain individuals who are by the bench, by the penalty box. Okay? Mm-hmm. I make this comment. Now, I make this comment, and it gained some traction on some certain websites. After the game, Sharks win. I'm a guy who's been in the National Hockey League in one form or another for 20 years. I've won a few Emmys, local, mind you. I try to be a good dad. I've done a lot of things for my kids. And after the game, the first thing my son Donovan says to me is, "Dad, you made puck, Daddy. I'm so proud of you. Where did I go wrong?" That's my question to you, is where did I go wrong?
I couldn't tell you, sir. Well, I've often said that making the blog is a bigger deal than winning a Bay Area Emmy.
Northern California, not just Bay Area.
Northern California then. Well, Hills Country.
The first time in my life my son has told me he's proud of me is because I made Puck Daddy.
Well, your son is brilliant, and I appreciate his support of the blog. What you're talking about, of course, was that you assailed the green men.
Yes, I did.
You and Randy Hahn did. During one of the games.
Yes.
It was hilarious.
Thank you.
Would
you like to know the follow-up?
I'd like to know the follow-up, but I must ask one question, though.
Yes.
Who was it that referenced a potholder collection?
Randy.
a follow-up, Drew.
Yeah.
Who has a potholder collection?
Randy.
Wow.
He's going to kill me for that. So I threw the snow globes in there. So the next day, the green men are the only guys who actually took it with any sense of humor. They sent Randy a tweet, because, you know, I don't tweet. And they had some picture of somebody's snow globe collection. Okay?
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was an awesome. And so Randy and they tweeted, "You have to admit, it's an awesome collection." Randy texts back, "Congratulations, say hi to your mom for us," because we referenced that they lived in their mom's basement. Before game two, I'm walking down Robson Street. I pass one of those little souvenir shops, and what do I see in the window of one of those little souvenir shops? Vancouver Canucks snow globes.
Yeah.
I have to buy them, right? I'm pulled into this, and I buy two of them. Randy and I sign them. Randy writes, "Hey, green guys, we're okay, right?" And I wrote one, "Sorry about the 40-year-old virgin comment. I know you guys are nowhere near 40. And so I take it down to the usher, because it's before the game. I take it to the usher, and before the game, I tap him on the shoulder. I said, "Hi, my name's Drew Remenda." And he turns and he starts laughing right away. And he goes, "Green guys." I went, "Yeah." And he goes, I said, "Can you give these to them for me?" And he goes, "Snow globe?" Yes, as a matter of fact, because we had it wrapped up. unfortunately, they didn't make game two, unfortunately, but somehow they got them. They took pictures of them, and then Yeah, it was pretty funny. So it was a nice little excursion.
you know what you need to do, Drew, is and I can get you in touch with Ryan Sullivan, who's one of the green men. You got to do their podcast.
They have a podcast?
It's awesome, too. Yeah, it's a really good podcast.
No.
I've been on it. I think, Greg, have you been on it?
I did not.
I have. Everyone who lives in their mom's basement has a podcast.
Exactly. Both me and Greg. "Quiet, Mom, I'm doing the podcast. Jeez, get off my back.
Mom, meatloaf.
Mom, I don't care. I'll eat lunch later. Anyway, back to the podcast.
She's not my girlfriend, Bob. She's just my friend.
How are you, Drew? That's a great story. How you been, bud?
I'm good. I've been great. I've been terrific. Things are nice for the San Jose Sharks.
Hey, I want to dial it back to that Vancouver series for a second. I got an interview with Logan Couture coming up on Puck Daddy today, and I was going over the notes, and I asked him about not getting suckered into the extracurricular off the ice banter with Vancouver.
Yeah.
Because Bieksa came hard.
Yeah.
With the diving stuff against Thornton and Couture, not only evoking the diving thing, but basically calling them less than Canadian for embellishing. Are you impressed that the Sharks didn't get suckered into that stuff?
Yeah, I really am. And the funny thing about that whole, I was standing in the hallway when Kevin Bieksa started. Now, the first one, when he did his first rant, he's standing in front of about four guys. And then because Henrik was out there and so was Ryan Kessler. So he does his little bit in front of like four reporters, and then he realizes this isn't getting a lot of play. So he waits for a while until Henrik and Ryan Kessler are done, and then the rest of the reporters come over to him with the cameras and everything, and he starts the whole thing all over again, even with the props of the stick and everything else. And so he waited, and it's what guys do in the playoffs. They're trying to get a call. They're trying to get that edge, find it somehow to get back in a series or gain the advantage in a series. So he does his thing, and the next day, both Joe Thornton crowd around him, Logan Couture crowd around him, and neither could be interested in what Kevin Bieksa had to say. I was very impressed with their focus. I was very impressed nobody else jumped out, maybe except Adam Burrish. But that's Adam Burrish. I guess poetic justice, if you're a Sharks fan, was the fact that Kevin Bieksa was in the penalty box for the tying goal late in game four, and then the Sharks won it in overtime, so on a power play. So for Shark fans, it was kind of poetic justice.
Have you ever talked to, speaking of Logan Couture, have you ever talked to him about the Dvorsky family?
No. Does he know the Dvorsky family?
Well, referee Paul Dvorsky his older brother Greg Dvorsky in the NHL, their mother was the delivery room nurse when Logan Couture was born.
No way.
You never asked him about that?
I've never known that. Well, no, because you know everything. You actually work at your job. Jeff, I'm a prima donna broadcaster. I show up. There's no fair. Randy does most of the work. I draw in the telestrator. I look like a genius. Lots of colors.
Have you ever asked him about that? No, because you know everything.
I don't know anything about the. I
thought that was common knowledge.
I didn't even know he was born in Ontario, for crying out loud, until you just said that.
He's from Lucan, Ontario, home of the Black Donnellys, legendary violent family in the London area.
Logan is a legendary violent guy, without a doubt. So yeah, it does make sense.
Oh yeah,
but you know, when you look at Logan though, it doesn't surprise me there's a hockey tie to Logan being born, because everything Logan does, there's a hockey tie to it. He lives, eats, and breathes the game. A quick story about Logan: the day after the Sharks win in game four, the next day at practice, after everybody's, you know, had they had day off, and then the next day, Logan is in the lunchroom after the Sharks practice watching game four on his iPad, watching the broadcast again. And that's what he is. He's a student of the game. He's a hockey guy.
Indeed. Los Angeles Kings and San Jose Sharks. Now, I am picking the Sharks in the series because I am gullible.
Nice.
I feel like there's something different about the Sharks team. But at the same time, the Kings, to me, Drew Remende, are playing the type of hockey that we saw them play when they went on a roll to win the Cup last year. I think by far this is the most compelling series of the four that we have been given. What's your take on Sharks and Kings?
I agree with you that it is by far the most compelling series. It's a series that I can't say that anybody, you know, the Sharks wanted. Don't get me wrong. It is the one they wanted because travel, it's great, because the California rivalry is great, and because they're very familiar with this team. There is something different about the San Jose Sharks. And I've been around there for a long time, as you know, guys. I keep fooling them. They keep hiring me. There is something different, and Ray Ferraro said it, there's a freshness about this team. And it started when there were some trades made. Obviously, Douglas Murray, Ryan Clough, and Michael Hanzus get traded. The Douglas Murray trade fired a shot across the attention bow of the players. There's a guy who grew up in the organization, and then all of a sudden Doug Wilson trades him, and everybody's got the message of, oh, that can happen, And all of a sudden, things change. Brent Burns gets moved up and by Todd McClellan to forward. Then that allows Logan Couture to go to center where he should play, and Joe Pavelski go to third-line center, sometimes second-line center, where he should play. Gave him a little bit more balance, gave him a little bit more speed with Brent Burns up front. TJ Gagliardi found his game. Scott Gomez, I'm telling you, Scott Gomez, I could speak hours on how great Scott Gomez has been. I know his stats aren't blowing you away, but when you see a fourth-line center hold the puck, control the puck, control the play like he does, Todd McClellan calls him a fourth coach out there. I think that should be fifth coach, actually, with the many coaches the Sharks have. The fifth coach out there. The type of person he is in the dressing room, the type of response he gets from his players and how he makes other guys better. The second-line power play unit is way better with Scott Gomez. So you've got strength down the middle. You've got Niemi playing well. But then Rafi Torres gets brought in by Doug Wilson, and that changed and gave a new attitude and freshness and speed to the Sharks that they hadn't had all year and maybe for quite a while. And it's a different team, a more confident team, a more of a belief in each other, and a more belief in their system and what they're doing and how to win.
You know, I'm glad you brought up that point about Scott Gomez, too, because we were making this all last year when, you know, Scott Gomez was having those horrible struggles. The way that Montreal plays and the way that Montreal wanted Scott Gomez to play, that's not Scott Gomez's game.
No.
Montreal wanted that, you know, chip it in, chase it, take it out of the corners. I always thought that Scott Gomez would work better with a team that wanted to hold on to the puck and make plays, like a Chicago, like a Detroit, or as we found now with the San Jose Sharks. So when he finally ended up, you know, signing with San Jose, it seemed to us, I think I'm speaking out for Wish here, but I think we're on the same page. It kind of seemed like the perfect marriage, didn't it?
It really did. And it took him a while to get it. It took him a while to play because, you know, early in the year, the Sharks were playing chip it deep and go after it. They were playing a forecheck game, and they still do rely on their forecheck. But in the Vancouver series, and the game kind of changed and the way the team kind of changed, in the Vancouver series, Todd McClellan was getting 10, 12 minutes out of Scott Gomez. That's great. He was able to be, I said fourth line center. I guess that's the term we use. But for a fourth line center, it's fantastic minutes. And that second power play unit was good because of Scott Gomez. And I am, you know, I didn't know Scott before he came to San Jose because he spent his life on the East Coast, everybody in the East playing in that conference. The guy is an amazing individual. He's a super person. He's funny. He's king of the deadpan, and he'll stump you like crazy. But the guys absolutely love him. He's a great leader.
And last one for me, if things work out for the Sharks, and let's say, I don't know, that they win the cup or something.
Come on.
Would the world be ready for Patrick Marleau as a Conn Smythe winner? Like, could we?
I think the world will be.
Would the universe implode?
Would Jeremy Roenick be set for that on itself?
He will not be able to handle Patrick Marleau as a Conn Smythe winner. Patrick Marleau, listen, I'll tell you this story. Mike Babcock and I know Mike for like 40 years. We've been, you know, we knew each other in Saskatoon growing up, and we were in Detroit a while back, and being a broadcaster, of course, and being around the team, you get a little contemptible every once in a while when you're with your team, and you start talking about guys, and Mike and I are talking about players, and I'm not giving Patrick glowing recommendations. And he turns, looks at me and goes, you know, he said, you broadcasters, you just don't get it, do you? He said, Patrick Marleau is a player. He can skate, he can score, he can make plays. He goes, you've been around him too long. You don't understand how great he is, how good he is as a player, and how every other team going against him, when you're talking about a lineup, you circle Patrick Marleau and you go, we got to watch out for this guy and his speed and his ability to score. He can make plays. He's a big body who, you know, everybody looks at him and he doesn't have that fire, doesn't have that passion. It's not true. With Patrick Marleau, he's got that fire and passion, but he controls it. He keeps it under control. Jeremy Roenick can say what he wants about Patrick Marleau, and he has before, but he's second in the league right now in active players and playoff goals, and he's right behind Jaromir Jagr. If the Sharks are going to be successful and continue to run, Patrick's going to be the guy that's going to take them there.
And, you know, the one thing, and we'll conclude on this one, Drew, and as always, thanks for your time and great stories, mind you, today as well. Rafi Torres never ceases to amaze me, and for the fourth time in as many years with four different teams, mind you, Rafi Torres is once again in the playoffs. Doug Wilson said recently he's been trying to get Rafi Torres for a number of years. What does he bring, other than, you know, speed and, you know, some physicality, what does he bring to the San Jose Sharks?
predictability as a winger. I haven't met very many guys, you know, guys understand there's a role to play. But there's many guys that don't want to play that role or don't really have an understanding of how to go out there and do it time after time after time. Rafi Torres knows exactly how he has to play in order to be successful, in order to be an impact player. And he does it time after time after time. Every shift you see him go out there, and he makes guys look up before they want to make a play. He rushes defensemen in making plays that they would normally make. He puts a little hurry on them and causes them problems. He's a guy who has a complete 100% understanding of how he needs to play to be effective, and he carries it out. He's consistent in that manner.
Awesome. Drew Remenda, you, sir, are a gentleman and a scholar, and we appreciate your storytelling.
Thank you.
We appreciate your whimsy. We admire the cut of your jib.
Thank you very much. That's never been admired before, and I've always said to people, I have terrific jib.
You have some fine jib.
It's a pleasure to always have you on this podcast whenever you're on, and we will talk to you soon, sir.
Anytime, guys. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Drew. The man, Drew Remenda, is outstanding. That is a funny story about the Green Man. That, right. You know what? I am going to text Ryan Sullivan as we speak.
Matchmaker.
I am. Watch this.
Your plate. Yeah.
What should I write? Hey, Sully. Oh, that's an email. Oh, jeez. Text. Ding, ding, ding. This is a fascinating podcast here. Hey, Sully. Want Remenda on your podcast.
So while you're texting, Glenn Gulitzin fired today by the Dallas Stars. I think we all kind of saw that coming when we had Jim Nill on this very podcast. He said, well, you know, you meet somebody and you interview him and you see. New GM wants his own guy.
Generally, that happens. Yeah. I mean, there are exceptions. The one, you know, notable one, which may come to a screeching halt sooner than later, is Mike Gillis and Lane Vigneault.
Right.
That was the head coach that Mike Gillis absorbed when he took over the reins. And there was that uncomfortable few weeks where Gillis just sort of left Vigneault twisting in the wind. Remember that executives management meeting in, I think it was in Las Vegas, and everybody went except for Lane Vigneault, and we all said, uh-oh. That's it. That's it. Vigneault's toast. But he's managed to survive up until now. But, yeah, you're right. Normally a GM comes in, wants to bring in his own guys.
Right. True. So it's a shame. I think he's a good young coach. I enjoyed talking to him in the past. I think he's a bright guy. Would not shock me to see him get another opportunity. Question being, though, Merrick, would it have to be as an assistant next, or do you think this is a guy who could get hired by? Let me just focus in. Is this guy Pete DeBoer? Will he be a guy who gets another kick at the can with this having been his first gig?
Pete's kind of a freak that way in that he went to a an underachieving team and was able to to pull himself into a position of a little more respectability in the coaching ranks. I don't know when you consider how the Dallas Stars haven't made the playoffs under his reign. I don't know that he gets a head coaching position before he gets an assistant coaching position in the NHL. Or maybe even goes back to the American League and coaches a team there.
Yeah, potentially. So there you go there. Yeah, now where do they turn? Yeah, so once again, this is another situation where there's a coaching opening, and the first name that you hear from some circles is a return of Dave Tippett. Because Tippett's contract is up this summer with the Coyotes. Just like everybody that's in Phoenix, everyone just assumes they want the hell out of there because, you know, Glendale is such a terrible place to live. I'm making the wanking motion with my hand right now. But Scott everybody thinks he's going to go to Colorado. Everybody thinks he's going to go to Dallas. Where does Dallas turn for their next coach?
I think they go with someone a little more. They have to go. First of all, they have to go with a teacher, right? I mean, that's going to be a young squad. That's the way that team is training. So you need to go with a teacher, someone that's grown with a young team before. So take your pick who that may be. Lindy Ruff has been through that with the Buffalo Sabres before. And help turn, you know, little minnows into Marines. we'll see what happens with Lane Vigneault.
How about
that? Could be an option as well.
How about somebody?
How about just keeping Kurt Fraser?
How about somebody with a little bit of Dallas legacy? How about Guy Carbonneau?
It's a great one. Yeah. Yep. That's a great one. Yep, that is outstanding. Or someone else with a Dallas legacy who is in the organization right now, although I don't know necessarily that he wants it at this point in his career, but I've always felt that Bob Gainey was a better coach than a general manager. Or I'll give you another one. I'll give you another
please.
One here, Wish.
Yes.
And you want to talk about, if you want to talk about, you know, growing with young players and grooming young players, and someone who has a Medicine Hat Tigers background, much like Jim Nill, who's in the organization right now coaching the American Hockey League affiliate, what about Willie Desjardins?
Willie Desjardins. That's
who everyone already has said for years, you know, he is an NHL coach waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So no shortage of opportunities and possibilities here for Jim Nill. And maybe, you know what, maybe just sticks with Kurt Fraser.
And again, you could do a lot worse than taking over a roster that has Lou Eriksson and Jimmy Benn and Brendan Dillon and more help on the way.
If they keep Lou Eriksson, though. If they keep
what?
Lou Eriksson, that's the key.
Oh, come on.
I'm just saying, put it out there.
Dude, he's
put it in your hip
pocket. He's so underrated.
Underrated.
So
I know. He flies.
Underrated. Oh,
under
my God.
Under the radar.
Won't
man.
Someone
Nobody
think
knows.
Of Louis Erickson? He's so underrated.
Nobody knows about Louis Erickson, he said pretentiously.
The other team we didn't really... We talked about this series yesterday. Somebody was giving us shit on Twitter about not talking about the Ducks. We talked about the Ducks series against the Red Wings. We broke that down a little bit. But we didn't do the picking over the corpse of the Ducks. What happens now for Anaheim? What do they do coming out of this series? It's funny. It seems like everybody has forgotten that this was not a team people picked to be a second seed. I believe I had them on the outside looking in on the playoffs. To me, the first thing they do is they trade Jonas Hiller. They open up that cap space. They're going to need it because they're paying Getzlaf and Perry a buttload of money. And then you go from there.
Ooh. Really, eh? You trade him?
What, do you hold on to him? Over Victor
Fastatha? He did have a good playoff.
4.5 million, though, dude.
I know. I understand that. I understand the economics of it. I get all that. Well, I think the first thing the Anaheim Ducks are going to do is what the Anaheim Ducks do every year. Ask Teemu Selänne what he wants to do. And Teemu will say, I don't know, let me get back to you, and then the drama is on again. Wake me when that is over this year. would it surprise you if Saku Koivu retired?
No. Looked like he lost his step, right?
Yeah, although, you know, who did he play with? He played with Andrew Cogliano and Daniel Winnick. It's a good line. It was a really good line.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know, at his age, being through it. See, guys, like, when you look at what Anaheim has right now by way of forwards, and it seems to be a nice little combination of veteran guys like Teemu Selänne, veteran guys like Saku Koivu, a bunch of, you know, by NHL standards, middle-aged guys like Bobby Ryan and Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaf. Then you get to some young guys like Emerson Edom, Nick Bellino, Matt Pileski, these types of players. So don't you kind of want those guys to hang around a little bit longer to try to help develop these kids?
Yep.
Right?
You
like,
would.
Aren't you saying, like, hold on a couple more years?
Yep.
You know, we'll pay you to mentor these guys. But Teemu Selänne and Saku Koivu are both unrestricted free agents. And we saw, like, some great glimpses from Emerson Edom and Matt Pileski and Nick Bonino. Like, the future of that team at the forward position. Mm-hmm. Kind of want those guys hanging around, don't you? At least till, you know, Emerson Edom and Matt Pileski are restricted free agents. Nick Bonino as well.
Eric Stevens has been tweeting up a storm from the immediate availability for the Ducks amongst the revelations that Francois Beauchemin was playing with a torn ACL for a while and will undergo surgery as soon as they can arrange it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, he's a man. He's tough, man.
Ryan Getzlaf's right ankle was never right after injuring it March 3rd against Dallas when he got tied up with Jamie Benn. And Bob Murray vows the team won't be back as is, did indicate that he wants Koivu to return. We'll have talks with Selänne over the next while.
Okay, so doesn't want it to return as is, but he wants Selänne and Koivu back.
Yeah, right. It's like at some point.
We're going to make changes, but we want everyone to come back.
Okay. Well, it's like it's the same reaction as like you hear in D.C. for the Capitals losing. It's like, that's it. Enough of this. We're tired of the same old shit. Okay, who do you want to trade? Well, not Backstrom or Ovi or Johansson or Brower or Holtby or Alsner or Carlson, I'll tell you. Or Green.
Oh, you know what? We gotta bring Hendricks back because we need that bottom six toughness. And you know, Ribeiro was pretty good too, so you gotta bring him back.
Right. So at the end of the day, the only guy who goes is Eric Fair. Yeah, or Tom Pody.
You let Tom Pody go. Well, he's UFA. Let him walk anyway. Right.
Before we get to the games tonight and the question of the day, we should mention that our favorite award finalists were announced today. That, of course, is the Hologram Bill Masterton Award given to the player who shows the most potential for a lifetime original movie, i.e. cancer or rickets, some kind of an STD, a horrific injury where we can see the bones stick out. Like, any of these things will contribute to you winning the Masterton Trophy. The nominees this year, of course, are... Sidney Crosby, who, of course, went through that quasi-concussionary hell and then came back and then took a puck to the jaw, the whole bit. A gentleman by the name of Adam McQuaid, who I forgot had a crazy disease that had blood clots all inside of him.
Yep.
There was some real concern about his well-being. And a guy I like to call winner because he won this award without a second thought. And he is Josh Harding of the Minnesota Wild, who, of course, is battling multiple sclerosis. And
Do you think this will be much like Pete Peters when he won the Vezina, that he'll win every first-place vote?
I can't imagine.
Like, how do you not vote for Josh Harding?
Right.
Like, it'd be like, you know, Maurice Richard after the five-goal game. He's a first, second, and third star. Like, how do you not, like, just like, okay, how many votes do we get? Five. Okay, Josh Harding five times. That would be my ballot if I was part of the PWHA.
To the shock of no one, I gave Harding my number one vote. I gave Sid my number two. Number three on my list, though, and here's... Listen, we can't really gripe about the Masterton because it's an award that exists to honor those who have gone through more personal hell than either of us have gone through. My third one went to Dan Ellis of the Carolina Hurricanes. I think when you talk about perseverance, sportsmanship, all that jive, a guy who is hung in there as long as Ellis has, the capacity he's been in, and really has been willing to do things, you know, like take tryout contracts and shit like that.
He put up with Ryan Lambert.
Right, exactly. And me too.
He put up with Ryan Lambert.
So I gave my third vote to Ellis. I thought he deserved it for hanging in there and doing what he could to stay in the National Hockey League.
I like the Masterton. I like what it represents. The only one that I've ever looked at kind of like sideways was when, actually, and it was one of my favorite hockey players too, won it, and that's Ian LaPerriere. Because he didn't come back.
He didn't come back, he did things that may not necessarily be in keeping with the award.
Well, I mean, he blocked a shot with his face.
There's perseverance and there's stupidity, right? Do you agree on that?
Yeah, but the thing is, like, he didn't come back the next year. He was done.
Yeah.
That was it. Like, there was, I can't figure out how Ian LaPerriere won that.
Well, that, and also the fact that, you know, let's face it. Oh, you took a puck to the face and your teeth all melted. You got a concussion. Well, I died.
Yeah, the hologram Bill Masterton, ladies.
It was great to see everybody making that reference this morning with him.
Right away, as soon as he came out,
like, I died.
I got so many "I died" comments today on Twitter from that bit last year.
If you're new to the show and you don't know the bit, I actually have the bit embedded on the Masterton post on Puck Daddy. If you want to watch it or listen.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I do. Good. I do. Someone was kind enough to put it on.
Oh, you had to eat through a straw for a couple of weeks. Number 87, did you? I die. Milkshakes for 2 weeks.
Oh, you came down with a genetic disease that threatens your well-being as a goaltender because your muscles are all going to seize up. Well, I died.
Check it out on Puck Daddy. It was one of our... it might be my favorite moment on this podcast.
Prediction time, sir.
Oh, I'm bad at these, man. I'm awful at these.
Let's start off in the Western Conference, Chicago Blackhawks and the Detroit Red Wings. The final time these two teams will play as division rivals, I am picking the Blackhawks in six. I think Detroit's going to start this series rather strongly. I think they got a lot of momentum coming off that Game 7 win. If they play anywhere like they did in Game 7 against the Ducks, they're going to win one of these games in Chicago. But at the end of the day, I think the Blackhawks are going to be able to take advantage of that Detroit defense, which is average, which is inexperienced in ways that Anaheim did not. So I'm picking Chicago in the series in six.
Well, you know me, Greg Wyshynski. I love an original six matchup.
You love the original six with all of your heart. We know that to be true.
Okay, so it's an arbitrary six matchup between the Blackhawks and the Detroit Red Wings. See, I like Chicago all over this one. I mean, I love what the Red Wings did in the last series. I love that third line, the two Swedes and a Swiss. I totally dig it. I share the same concerns you do about their blue line. That may end up being their Achilles. But the scary thing for me, if I'm the Detroit Red Wings, is a lot of the big boys for Chicago really had kind of a snoozy time against the Minnesota Wild. And Joel Quenneville was really quick to point that out, like right away as soon as they eliminated Minnesota. You know, too many guys, we didn't have guys playing their best, you know, we weren't playing our best hockey. It wasn't anywhere close to Chicago Blackhawks hockey. I'm betting that Joel Quenneville has these guys ready to rock and roll start game one. And that it's going to be a game one disaster for this to me looks like a game one disaster for Detroit. Not saying Detroit can't pull it back together because they've gone to hell before in a single game and come back and, you know, bounce back and won. But I just think that first game, look for Chicago to really try to throw a pace on Detroit that a lot of teams have a hard time keeping up with.
Right.
You know, like they can throw a pace on you and it's like, all right, you can hang for a period. Okay, we're hanging for two periods. By the time the third period rolls around, you're just dog tired and you're dog beat. Look for Chicago to do that in game one at least. I'm thinking Chicago in six.
Chicago in six. Okay, there you go.
Sure.
We agree. The other series is fantastic. I can't understand if you don't make time in your life to watch this series because it is as unpredictable a series that I've witnessed in these playoffs. It's two teams that are at the top of their powers entering the series. Sharks and Kings. I've got the Sharks in seven. I'm going down this road, Merrick. I am buying what they're selling. I am drinking the Kool-Aid. And I think Niemi is a factor. I think the fact that this is no longer a team that needs Thornton and Marlowe to lead the way, it's a factor. And I just think that at some point, someone's going to find a way to break through that Kings defensive front, and I think it's going to be the Sharks. Sharks in seven.
Ooh, controversy. Well, it's two teams that just come off winning four games in a row. So you're right about two teams at the height of their powers, two teams that just went on four-game winning streaks. As much as I do love what San Jose has done, and you know, the minute Matt Irwin became a factor for San Jose, that was it for Douglas Murray. I like the fact they traded three slow guys on that team, with, you know, Hanzus getting the punts, and we talked about Douglas Murray leaving town as well. It's a team that, you know, Ryan Clough as well. It's a team that got deliberately quicker for the playoffs, and they got more dangerous in Rafi Torres. And my history with Rafi Torres is well known on this podcast. I love the guy. I love Brent Burns as a winger, specifically playing with Joe Thornton and TJ Gagliardi. But at the end of it, I still am terrified. I'm frightened to play the Los Angeles Kings. When you look at all three lines, it can do a little bit of everything. And you're starting to see Mike Richards and Jeff Carter heat up. The Regier-Doughty battery on defense is one of, if not the best pairing in the NHL right now. Skidarian Martinez and Voinoff with the youngster Jake Muzz. I just love, to say nothing of what Jonathan Quick has done after game two against the St. Louis Blues. I love them at every single position. But this one, Greg Wyshynski, we should really call, you know, not just the conference semifinal. This one should be called the Sutter Bowl. This is Daryl Sutter versus his own team, his old team. I'm not sure that Daryl Sutter is going to allow the Kings to lose this one. I'll take the Kings in six.
There you go. Eastern Conference, Pittsburgh and Ottawa. Thomas Mokoun gets the start in game one for the Penguins.
By the way, hang on. Really quick. Little known fact here to pull a Cliff Clavin. This is the first time the Kings have opened up on home ice since 1992.
Damn.
They've had 16 straight series opening on the road.
Wow.
The first time they've done it at home.
Crazy.
Anyway, continue. Sorry.
Pens and Sens. Vokoun gets the start in game one, which I think is the only decision they could make given what Fleury has given them. So they'll ride that hand for a little bit longer. this is an interesting one. I've seen some people picking Ottawa in this series, and for good reason. They've got some things going for them. They've got those little storylines that tell you that this could be a team of destiny in some ways, and they also have a goaltender in Craig Anderson that could easily stymie the Penguins over the course of seven games. But I think the Pens win the series. I think the goaltending thing will sort itself out, and I see Sidney Crosby and company finding a way to pierce the armor of Craig Anderson and you know, maybe slice the other leg for Erik Karlsson at some point. You know, just kind of give him a full smile and end his season for good. Complete the job, as it were. Pens in six is what I say.
I want to see Eugene Melnyk sniffing around the Pittsburgh Penguins locker room with sunglasses on as CSI Ottawa is in full effect. A couple of things here. The Pittsburgh Penguins this series will not face Yevgeny Nabokov. Quite the opposite. They will face Craig Anderson, maybe the best goaltender, were he not injured for a large part of it, in the NHL this season. And conversely, the Ottawa Senators will not face off against the Montreal Canadiens. They will face off, Montreal Canadiens forwards. They will face off against the Pittsburgh Penguins forwards. Okay, these aren't like a couple of guys that can kind of sting you, bumblebee attack. These are large men who can play significant minutes and play great hockey, dazzling hockey, scoring bunches. Kunitz, Crosby, Dupuis, Yaginla, who's been fantastic, by the way. Neil, Malkin, Brandon Sutter can score. Cook is one of the best defenders on the PK in the entire NHL. This is a team up front that is stacked. The Penguins aren't facing Nabokov, and the Ottawa Senators aren't facing the Montreal Canadiens forwards. Two teams that are meeting completely different opponents than they saw in the first round. I like Pittsburgh because of their depth. I'm with you. I think the goaltending is going to be fine. I think eventually at some point in the series, the net goes back to Marc-Andre Fleury. I'll take Pens in five.
Five. Wow.
And then the New York... King Kong Bundy. King Kong Bundy. I'll take them in King Kong Bundy.
The New York Rangers. The New York Rangers and the Boston Bruins. I expect Rick Nash will make an appearance in the series, which is good news for the Rangers. I think Lundqvist will continue to play extraordinarily well. I think you had the Bruins nailed, sir. I don't think that they are all that great this year. I think they're a problematic team in some ways, and I think the Rangers will expose some of those problems. The offense that you saw from the Rangers in the Capitals series was encouraging. I think it will continue in this series. It will go long. It'll be a very exciting series, but I think the Rangers will win in six.
Well, you know me, Greg. I love an original six matchup.
It's true.
Round two of the arbitrary six, the Boston Bruins and the New York Rangers. You see, I'm looking at it one of two ways. One, the way that you just described, where I say to myself, of course I'm picking the Rangers in this one. And then I say to myself, great teams need a scare. And Boston just had a big one. And I know I'm only basing this on what I saw in 10 minutes of hockey. But if that's the scare the Boston Bruins needed, and if they can replicate what we saw in the last 10 minutes of last night's game, it may be a dangerous time to be a New York Ranger, Henrik Lundqvist notwithstanding, who will probably have to stand on his head if the Rangers are going to do anything here. This to me is an I don't know. I really have no clue how this series is going to go. And that's why I'll say it's going to go seven. It's going to go seven because I don't know how it's going to end up. Rangers, sure. Boston, sure. You can be pretty certain this will probably be a low-scoring affair, Wish. Uh-huh. But I have zero idea how this thing ends up. But if I'm going to be put on the line to make a prediction, I'll take the Boston Bruins in seven.
Awesome. Interesting stuff. All right. Take the beaners. Let's get some QODs before we head out here. Nick Kaner, this was again, would you rather lose like the Caps did or lose like the Leafs did? Nick Kaner, the way Washington lost was more like missing the last number in Powerball. The way Toronto lost Game 7 was equivalent to getting the winning lottery ticket and then it spontaneously catching fire 2 minutes before you get a chance to claim it. Random Penguin Tim Horton.
Tim Horton. Yeah, that's right.
Mike Baddock from Toronto. I'm a diehard Senators fan living in downtown Toronto. Basically the heart of darkness. Up until yesterday, I was an anti-Leafs fan. I cheered whoever the Leafs were playing against with gusto. That all changed last night. I now tolerate the Leafs and feel for their fans. There is no worse way to go out than that.
And this one comes from... Where did I put it here? Oh, from Jackie Klink. Toronto's loss is the worst. They worked their asses off in that last game. Washington, not so much. That comes back to my original point. Isn't this weird phenomenon in sports right now that you either have to completely suck or completely win the championship? There's like no in-between in sports.
Nope.
It's a complete loggerheads, complete black and white world now that we live in. Yep.
That's why.
I don't like that.
Yeah, that's why the gold, silver and bronze medal suck. Just be gold and nothing.
Well, at least with bronze, you win bronze. You never win silver.
No, it's true.
You always lose gold.
You sell for silver. Miriam writes in, "Hey guys, losing the way Toronto did is definitely worse. Running into a hot goalie and not being able to get anything going is certainly frustrating, but sometimes it's just nothing you can do. But having a decent lead until there's only about 10 minutes left and then losing it and losing in overtime, it's heartbreaking. You can only blame yourselves. It's like Blues and Kings last year compared to this year. Last year, the Blues couldn't solve quick, and running into that hot LA team, there was not a lot they could do about it. But this year, they had the series lead. They had every opportunity to make it 3-0 or 3-1 or at least take it to Game 7, but just couldn't. While Quick certainly turned it on again this year, the Blues mostly only have themselves to look at for reasons for not making it further."
Hmm.
Yeah.
Here's one that I don't think you'll like this one, Wish.
No.
Our buddy Mike in Buffalo. "The Leafs' historic loss was much worse, but they'll make up for it by signing Clarkson away from the Devils."
Marty Rapp from Mount Carroll, Illinois. "I just watched the video from Maple Leaf Square of the Leafs fans' reaction to Bergeron's goals, and all I could think of was the 2003 Cubs and the Bartman game. While the Leafs' collapse can't exactly be pinned on a curse-like event, the reaction of the crowd reminded me of that night." Yeah, right?
Yeah.
This is from
into that one, Uncle Amos submits, "Oversimplifying, Leafs may have played 2.5 periods, but they controlled the scoreboard for 58-30. That's way worse."
This is from John Phillips from Pennsylvania. "I've done some coaching in college. As a coach, I'd be more upset losing like the Capitals did. Listless and apathetic at times, no hustle, not playing your position correctly, not trying 100% every second of every shift. Toronto played hard the whole game, and Boston had the experience to work a comeback and win. Now, the other side, losing an OT of Game 7, that feels like a dagger in your heart. Toronto gave it its all on the ice, playing hard, then it's over on the bounce of a puck. It's the loss that'll stick in your memory and heart forever. But losing like the Capitals did is worse. They had no heart in the game to begin with."
It's one of those games that Leafs fans will talk about for how many years? Like, is that a generational game? And if it is, is it much like, because someone made this point earlier on the podcast, someone tweeted in, you know, teams have to learn how to lose before they learn how to win. And I think of those Islanders teams, you know, 1978, they lose to the Maple Leafs, stunning upset. The next year, they lose to the Montreal Canadiens, you know, another one there. I'm sorry, they lose to the New York Rangers, another stunning one there. And Rangers go on to lose to the Montreal Canadiens in the Stanley Cup final. Like, there has to be something said for teams that learn how to lose in the playoffs together. And that's what it comes down to for Toronto. It's up to them whether they're going to win or lose out of this one. They could be like the Philadelphia Flyers after they flamed out against the Detroit Red Wings. Remember that one? It could have been like a great team moment for the Philadelphia Flyers, and that team should have been as close to a dynasty team as possible, at least won a couple of cups with Eric Lindros there. Would you agree with that, Wish?
Yep.
Like, that Philadelphia Flyers team should have won some Stanley Cups. But after they lost to the Detroit Red Wings, it all came apart. No one on that team, and that was a great team, no one on that team treated it like a learning experience. So it's all going to come down to the coaching staff and the players on the Toronto Maple Leafs. Did they want to have boo-boo face about this one, or they say to themselves, we need to learn from this?
Boo-boo face.
Boo-boo face, yeah.
A couple more real quick before we head out here. This is from Jason Abraham. "Hey, gents, this comparison is the equivalent of to trying to figure out who the taller Gianta brother is. The Leafs' loss was far worse taken by itself, but in the long term, that loss is much more damaging to the Caps." Finally, Mike Wally writes, two more. Mike Wally writes in, "It has to be the way the Leafs lost. If you told me before the season we'd be in a Game 7, I'd be happy, and long term, I feel good about the team. Still hurts, though. I can't even listen to yesterday's podcast today." And then finally, on today's episode, from Daniel Burke, the subject is Merrick the new Pierre? And he quotes, Well, you see, Paul Dvorsky's mom was the delivery nurse who Loke Couture was born. And what's interesting is that he learned to skate right there in that delivery room right there that very night, Ed. So he even cut the umbilical cord with his own skate blade.
I honestly thought that was common knowledge. That everyone knew that Bernadette Dvorsky was the delivering nurse for Logan Couture. At least with Sharks fans, shouldn't it be? Her son's a ref in the NHL.
Logan Couture, Paul Dvorsky's mom, of course, went to Remington Nursing School over in Ontario.
Yeah.
Produced some of our best nurses, Enzo.
All right, everybody.
All right, I gotta do some stuff for sports.
Yeah, I gotta go too. There's like a thousand. This is like the busiest effing day in the history of days.
It's been a busiest week.
Gone over.
It's been nuts.
I think it was stress that made me yell at you so much at the beginning of the show, by the way. So I'll point that out.
Okay.
Also, you were wrong. I mean, you were wrong, but, you know.
Listen, I agree. Listen,
I put a little extra butter on the muffin this morning for today because of that.
I'd agree with you if you were right. All you gotta be is right, and I'll agree with you, bud.
Here's two guys that don't agree on anything. Merrick versus Wyszynski.
What happens when these two fellas finally get together on a podcast?
He's ketchup, he's mustard. He's meat, he's veggies.
They'll never get along. Let's put them together on a podcast.
He likes flying. He likes choo-choo trains. He likes sheep. He likes cows.
All right, I gotta go.
I'm Greg Wyszynski, Yahoo Sports.
Jeff America Sports. And tonight, Hockey Central, 11 o'clock, and then 1 o'clock Eastern, working with John Shannon and Neil Smith today, wrapping up two games in the National Hockey League. We got the Ottawa-Pittsburgh game and also the Los Angeles Kings-San Jose Sharks. Dig it.
Awesome. And like I said, we got previews of both games tonight, plus we got the predictions and all that good stuff coming up on Puck Daddy. Today. Thanks, everybody. We will see you tomorrow. Thanks to Drew Remenda for awesome storytelling time and all that good
stuff. Was good.
There you go. Go Sharks, ladies and gentlemen. On the Sharks bandwagon. Feel the teal, bitches. Bye.
From Feel the Teal. Thank you.